Eagles had a new coach, Chip Kelly, who had never had a job in the NFL before. The team went on to win 10 games, including a division title, after a paltry 4 wins the season before. Kelly also won the support of Philadelphia's notoriously opinionated and impassioned sports fans. His hurry-up offense and unorthodox approach to playing and practicing football was credited with turning the team around. For instance, his players wear heart monitors during practice. They get lots of sleep, they drink lots of fluid, even get individualized smoothies after practice to keep them healthy. So what does Kelly and his team have for football fans this season? How will they perform on Sunday's game against Jacksonville? What about the rest of the season? And for that matter, is football too dangerous to players' health for what we know about concussion? And we have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Ray Didinger is a football analyst for Comcast Sportsnet in Philadelphia. His latest book, The New Eagles Encyclopedia, has been updated. He's also the author, a co-author of 10 books, including One Last Read, the collected works of the world's slowest sports writer, and the ultimate book of sports movies. Ray Didinger, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be back, Marty.
Also with us is Mike Sielski. He's a sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's also written a couple of books, including Fading Echoes and How to Be Like Jackie Robinson, which he co-wrote with Pat Williams. And Mike Sielski, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks, Marty.
Let me begin with you, Mike, and I guess the big question today is what does Chip Kelly have in store for the season, but I guess most importantly for Sunday's game and maybe even the first couple plays of the game. What do you think he's got up his sleeve?
Well, everybody is curious about this, I think, in large part for two reasons. Number one, the team improved so much over the course of last season. You know, they started out 3-5 and then ended up winning 7 of their last 8 regular season games and won the division title. And it was clear that Chip's way of doing things was becoming more accepted among the players in the locker room. And they were kind of getting it all, they were understanding what he wanted and how he wanted it done. And then the other dynamic, I think, and Ray can speak to this too, is the opening of their first game last year when they played the Redskins in Landover, Maryland, was unlike anything that I think Eagles fans have seen before. There were these odd formations. There was this breakneck pace. And there was this. There had been this sense that Chip had kind of, that there was something hidden under a tablecloth, and he lifted the tablecloth, and there revealed was what he was going to do and how he was going to do it. So there is that sense now. You know, they play the Jacksonville Jaguars Sunday, and I believe there's this anticipation of, okay, what's he got in store now?
Is it sort of like, what does he have for an encore, or are we sort of over-anticipating what Kelly may do?
Oh, no, I don't think you're over-anticipating. I think he is, the level of excitement in the city is unlike anything we've seen since really 2004, when the team signed Terrell Owens and everybody had a sense the team might be on the path to a Super Bowl, which indeed happened that year. Level of excitement in the city and optimism is very akin to that. And that was more a function of the signing of Owens. This is more about the coach.
Yeah.
That's what makes this different, is this is so about the coach. I mean, they have good players. They have some real good players. But I think it's largely what Chip Kelly is, the sense that that he is really in some ways changing the way football's played at the NFL level. He's taken what's kind of a college approach and a college philosophy and proven that it can work here with professional players. And for them to have made the progress they made in 1 year, to go from 4-12 to 10-6, there's the expectation that, my goodness, how much better can they be in year number two?
And how much does it have to do with fluids and his approach, as you write in this book, a very kind of scientific approach that he has to keeping his players healthy. You see it on the practice field, perhaps see it on the game night.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there are two things. I think that the idea of the nutrition and the heart monitors and a lot of the stuff that none of us had seen before, it works. I mean, if you look at the team last year, they were the healthiest team in the league. They really lost one player. They lost Jeremy Maclin in the preseason. But throughout the season, they didn't lose anybody.
Wow.
Some of that's good luck, but not all of it. I mean, and the fact that they're very fit. And the other part of it is, in addition to the smoothies and the nutrition and all the monitoring and the sports science coaches that he has on his staff, the other part of it is just the way they practice. I mean, the way they practice at a pace pace that I've never seen. I've been around pro football for 40 years. I've never seen a team practice the way these guys practice. It's fast. It's like everything's at double time. And as a result, you wind up with a team that is extremely well-conditioned and can make it through a season, and on most Sundays is going to run the other team ragged in the second half.
Mike, talk about his relationship with the players. You had a piece today about his relationship with the quarterback, Foles. Mm-hmm. But it seems that he has, maybe within the NFL, a very kind of personal relationship with his players.
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic, and one that I want to keep an eye on as Chip is here longer and coaches more games and encounters more players. He seems to be more personable in a certain sense than a lot of football coaches perhaps are, or certainly different from the stereotype of the kind of disciplinarian overseer who, you know, go run a lap now, that kind of thing. He doesn't seem to handle things that way. And his relationship with Nick Foles, the quarterback, is kind of emblematic of that. The idea that Foles got injured in a game last year, suffered a concussion, had to leave the game. You know, before the afternoon was finished, Chip had gone over and asked Nick, "How are you? Are you okay?" Which, in the heat of the moment and in the heat of a game, is relatively rare for an NFL head coach to do. From a quarterback standpoint, Foles is supposed to be kind of the chosen person on the roster. The quarterback is supposed to be the most important player on the roster. So I'm curious to see how that dynamic plays out between the two of them, because if Chip is that sort of sensitive and one-on-one-ish with each of his players, it also means he's kind of treating all his players the same way.
Yeah. Is that a good thing, do you think?
Well, I think it can be a good thing. I think it's an interesting dynamic for a quarterback because, you know, people still want to see, you know, how good Nick Foles really is. He was terrific last season, threw 27 touchdown passes and only 2 interceptions. But he's still on his rookie contract. He's relatively inexpensive for the Eagles to have. And there is kind of this lingering sense that if things don't go real well this year, the Eagles may say, well, we might be able to improve at quarterback if we draft this other guy or sign this other guy and get somebody in here who Chip Kelly really wants. So by treating everybody special in a way, he's not treating anybody special. And so I'm just curious to see how that dynamic plays out.
Ray, you have a quote in your chapter on Nick, the quarterback, that Ray Kelly says, Chip Kelly, excuse me, that he's not fleet of foot, he's fleet of mind.
Mm-hmm. That was
Chip. Smart, I guess.
Yeah, that was actually Chip's statement, because so many of us, and I'll admit to saying this too, when Chip came in and we had seen Chip's teams at Oregon and we had seen the way they played and the kinds of quarterbacks that he liked, then when he came here we said, well, Nick Foles certainly doesn't fit that mold. You know, that Chip wants a quarterback that's very athletic and very mobile and a guy that's going to run around and is going to pose a running threat as an addition to a passing threat. And Nick Foles is not that. So we just thought that Nick Foles doesn't figure here at all. Well, it turns out that he steps in here and Nick Foles becomes his quarterback and goes on to have a tremendous season. And it makes you rethink a lot of things. And the idea that we kind of knew what Chip Kelly was. Well, no, it turns out that he's a lot more flexible and adaptable than that. And also, what Chip said was, look, it's not about how fast he runs. It's about how quickly he can process information and how well he can make decisions on the fly. That's what his team's about. It's about making plays and not making mistakes.
What's interesting about that is, to piggyback exactly on what Ray's talking about, is I wrote a column earlier in January of this year about that. I had a former NFL player personnel director tell me that he had seen a psychological report of Foles before Foles was drafted. And Chip Kelly was not with the Eagles when they drafted Nick Foles. Andy Reid was the head coach at the time. But the report showed how, and it was something that hundreds of potential NFL draftees are given, but it showed that Foles scored very highly on the ability to process information. The idea that if you gave him and another player the same math problem, they would both get it correct, but it would take Foles about half the time to solve it that it would the other guy. And so here you are, this fortuitousness of having a quarterback who has that skill now fit with a head coach.
As hurry up as the coach is, right?
Right.
I mean, that same kind of pace. Do they have I know they have unusual and perhaps unorthodox plays. Are they complicated? Does anyone – I'm looking at – go ahead, Ray.
They're actually not. No. It's actually quite simple. And the other part of it that's simple is the terminology they use is much more streamlined. If you hear a lot of coaches and a lot of teams, if you hear a play call, it takes forever to get it out. It's X Y to the brown over,
formula,
and,
right?
and it goes on and on and on. And it kind of slows things down. And that's one of the things that Chip won't do. Chip wants to move everything at a fast pace, so everything is streamlined, and the language is streamlined. It's much easier for the players to handle.
Give us an example.
Well, a lot of what they do is done through hand signals from the sidelines, and so the quarterback doesn't have to call the blocking assignments for the offensive lineman. That's sent in by the offensive line coach by hand signals. They signal to the offensive line. They also signal to the quarterback. Each guy's getting his information independently. They get it quicker. They get up to the line of scrimmage, and they run the play. And that's a big part of it, and that's one of the ways that I think that Chip is influencing a lot of teams right now. A lot of teams are trying to run no huddle offense, and I think we're moving towards an era where in 5 or 6 years you're probably going to see very, very few huddles.
Well, I wonder too, Mike, after the other teams have had a chance to see how Chip Kelly runs the Eagles, do you think they're more ready for his style of play?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I do think that there is a natural advantage that the offense is always going to have by playing fast, because the offense's players know what they're doing and where they're going. You know, the wide receiver knows where he's going to run. The offensive linemen know where they ought to be blocking. So there's always going to be that advantage, and if you can quicken the pace, then you know you're forcing the defense to react to you. You know, Ray and I were talking before the show. There were measures that opponents took early in the season last year to try to counteract, what the Eagles were doing. There was even speculation that the NFL's referees and officials weren't going to let the Eagles play that fast, that they were going to kind of sit on the football for a second.
Just to give everyone a chance to catch their breath.
And not let Chip and the Eagles play at the pace that they wanted to. But as Ray mentioned, Chip has proven to be very adaptable and kind of saying, okay, well, what are you doing to try to stop me? And what's the logical thing that I ought to do to try to counteract that? And once I figure out, okay, what's the next iteration of your attempting to stop me, then I'll figure that out too. He doesn't seem to be kind of married to any sort of, I play a West Coast offense or I play a ground and pound offense and these sort of jargony terms that football coaches use.
Well, so he has that kind of brain, like his quarterback. I mean, it's that sort of fast analytic brain as well.
Yeah, it starts with him. It starts with the coach, as it usually does. But a lot of it is just an adaptability that all coaches have to have. And some coaches are less flexible than others. Mm-hmm. I mean, some coaches have a philosophy, and they're going to come in and they're going to run their game plan, and they're going to do what they want to do, and they're going to what they want to practice, regardless of what the other team does. And sometimes they wind up beating themselves in the process. Chip is the kind of guy that, look, okay, this is what I plan to do. It's not working. We're going to go do something else. And he's always looking for the way to win as opposed to the way to prove that he was right.
Oh, well, that's very interesting. Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about the Philadelphia Eagles, as we say here in the Philadelphia area, talking with Ray Didinger. He's a football analyst for Comcast Sportsnet in Philadelphia. His latest book, The New Eagles Encyclopedia, has been updated. In fact, you can catch up with Ray. He's going to be speaking at the Free Library of Philadelphia on Saturday, September 20th at 3 o'clock. Also with us is Mike Sielski, and he's a sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. We want to hear from you. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, The Body Lautrec by Aaron Cromie and Mary Twominen, a theatrical exploration of Henri Toulouse-Lautrec, a painter who equated the grotesque with the sublime. September 12th through the 22nd. Tickets at fringearts.com.
Winter's icy grip will soon put an end to our annual plants. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal how you can bring the brightest member of your shade garden inside for free indoor color all winter long, plus answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturdays at 7 a.m. and again at noon, right here on WHYY-FM.
The new film tells the story of the day before 9/11, including the waitress who served two of the hijackers their last meal.
Very hard to describe that feeling that these are two people that I had an interaction with, and they did something absolutely horrible to our country.
Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, the Lincoln Motor Company, introducing the first ever Lincoln MKC with available active noise control that reduces unwanted cabin noise to help provide a more pleasant driving experience. More at Lincoln.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. The Philadelphia Eagles kick off, sorry about that, their football season with a home game this Sunday against Jacksonville. After last year's surprising season, fans are looking forward to see what Coach Chip Kelly has up his sleeve. And we've been talking about that with Mike Sielski and with Ray Didinger. And again, we want to hear from the football fans in our audience. We will be talking about some of the concerns about this this game, this sport, a little bit later on in the show. I'd like to hear from you as well. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Let me ask you about DeSean Jackson, and he was let go, Mike, when? Last year or over
March.
The summer? In March.
Mm-hmm.
That seems like a risky thing to do considering what a great year he had.
Yeah, he had a career year in Kelly's offensive system. He had been the Eagles' most accomplished wide receiver anyway, and then he went out and had statistically the best year of his career. But I think a couple factors were at play with respect to his relationship with Chip Kelly and his place in the Eagles' offense. Kelly is somebody who kind of wants everybody swimming in the same direction, and there were whispers and intimations that DeSean kind of wanted to do his own thing, and receivers tend to be that way to a certain extent.
Plus, he'd done so well.
Right, exactly.
That,
that he had this confidence that, hey, I had 80 catches and 1,300 yards. I should be able to, you know, I should be special. The other dynamic, too, one that's kind of larger, you know, across the NFL, is that if you watched any of last season or even last night's first game, the Seattle Seahawks, the team that won the Super Bowl last year and won last night's game, are kind of initiating a trend throughout the NFL where teams on defense use bigger, faster, stronger defensive backs, the guys who cover the receivers. And DeSean is 5'10", 175 pounds, and Kelly is kind of mindful of that, of what are trends throughout the league, and do I really want my team's best receiver to be a relatively little guy when it comes down to, you know, third and goal from the 5-yard line, and I have to try to throw a pass to get in the end zone, and the cornerback is 6'2 or 6'3, and my receiver is 5'10. The odds are not great that my guy is going to come down with the ball in a kind of jump ball or 50-50 situation. So there were a number of factors there. I think all of them played a little bit of a role in Chip deciding, you know what, I can part with this guy and we'll be okay.
So how do you think, Ray, he's kind of filled in for the loss of DeSean Jackson or letting him go?
Well, we'll find out. We'll find out starting Sunday. But the first part of it is getting Jeremy Maclin back healthy. I mean, last year, Maclin, who's a really good receiver as well, was hurt and didn't play at all last year, which is part of the reason why they had to lean more heavily on DeSean Jackson. But Macklin's back, and he's healthy now. And I think in this offense, he's going to do quite well. They drafted a player from Vanderbilt in the second round named Jordan Matthews, who's a real good player, real good young player, who I think is going to step in here and help. And they made a trade for a player named Darren Sproles, who they acquired from New Orleans, who's a running back, but he actually is more of a receiver. So they're going to sort of distribute they're going to wind up distributing a lot of DeSean's catches and yards and touchdowns among those guys. And I think getting to the point of what kind of Mike was talking about, they probably won't hit as many 50 and 60 yard plays because they don't have anybody that can quite run the way DeSean ran. But what they want to become is they want to become more efficient in what football calls the red zone, which is from the 20 in, where the field kind of shrinks, and being more physical and a bigger target works to your advantage. The Eagles last year, for all of the yardage and all the big plays they hit, were only mediocre inside the 20-yard line. And that's an area where they want to get better. So this year, they may get fewer yards and fewer big plays, but if they score more touchdowns inside the 20, ultimately they'll be a better team, and I think that's what Kelly's counting on.
What do you see from the defense side, Mike?
Well, there's this assumption that they'll be better. They had a rough beginning last year. They brought in a new defensive coordinator named Bill Davis, and he changed their entire defensive scheme. Again, not to get too jargony, but from a 4-3, where you have four guys playing very close to the line of scrimmage and then three linebackers, he changed that to a 3-4, where you have three defensive linemen, the big guys in the front, and then four linebackers behind them. And it took a while for the Eagles' defense to kind of master that system. And there's still some upgrades on talent that they needed to make as well. So there is this sense that they ought to be better just because they're in his system for another year and more familiar with it, and made a couple upgrades, particularly at the safety position. But there is, I mean, there are obvious weaknesses. You need somebody to go after the quarterback and sack him, and they don't really have a player at the moment who seems to fit that bill, who can just kind of break an offensive line down on his own. And, you know, this is a passing-driven league, and there are concerns about how good their cornerbacks are, you know, just from play to play. So they should be better, but, you know, there are some concerns there, I think.
I ran across a quote from the Inquirer, not from you, but from one of your colleagues.
You're quoting somebody else?
I'm sorry.
Why do you bring me in here?
The quote is, and this is Davis talking about Kelly's system, every bit of it is different. It's so refreshing. I tell everyone that for 20 years I've been in this one NFL box of how to schedule things, the practice format, the meeting times, one box, 20 years. And now I'm with Chip, and it's another world. It's not even a square box. That's Bob Brookover writing that. But again, showing, I guess, just how different Chip Kelly is.
Yeah, I talked with Bill Davis, the defensive coordinator, a couple of weeks ago, and I asked him, I said, how is Chip different from any other coach you've either coached with or coached against? And he said, when you are sitting down figuring out how to counteract what he's doing, he takes you to places that you don't go with anybody else.
Wow.
You know, talking, as Ray mentioned earlier in the show, about the idea of Nick Foles not being a fast quarterback. Well, that doesn't mean that Nick Foles doesn't run with the ball within Chip Kelly's offense from time to time. And as a opposing defensive coordinator, you have to account for that. And you don't often have to do that with, you know, against Tom Brady or Peyton Manning or these other quarterbacks around the NFL.
We have Kevin, our engineer, who stuffed my head full of questions this morning, has a question for you. I'll toss it to you, Ray. Why wasn't Deshaun traded instead of let go?
Well, that was my one issue with the whole thing, is if you felt like you had to move on from him and you felt like he wasn't a fit. And part of it, I think, was the fact that Deshaun was a very much a me guy, and Chip Kelly wants a team kind of focus. If you wanted to move on from him and you felt like you could live without him, okay. But there's no way you should let a guy who's 26 years old, a three-time Pro Bowl guy, walk away and get nothing in return.
Yeah.
But the timing of it just didn't quite work for them. I think they mishandled it in the sense that it became common knowledge around the league that the Eagles are unhappy with this guy and are going to let him go. So teams kind of sat back and said, well, why should we trade for him if they're just going to release him anyway? So I think that the Eagles could have played their cards a little bit better in this case. But the bottom line being what it was, they felt like they could live without him. They felt like they would live better without him. And they didn't care a whit that he was going to Washington, who's a team in their division that they're going to play twice this year. They didn't care at all. Chip just said, look, I don't want to coach this guy. I think we can be as good an offense without him. Move him on. And if he goes to Washington, I really couldn't care less. We'll find out in week 4 when Washington comes to the link.
Well, exactly. But team, I mean, for Chip Kelly, it's all about the team.
Completely.
Sounds like you're both saying that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, very much. And one of the questions that we had to ask last year when Kelly came here with a guy that had no pro experience, he had never played in the league, he had never been an assistant coach in the league, there's a certain reserve among the veteran players about, okay, does this guy really belong here? Who is this guy? You know, I mean, he's a coach at Oregon, and finally won a lot of college games, but this is the NFL. And what determines how quickly these guys can succeed is how quickly the players buy into what the coach is selling. And Kelly did a very good job of early on saying, look, I'm going to ask you to do some things that you've never been asked to do before. You're going to practice different. You're going to eat different. You're going to sleep different. But here's why. You're going to do all this stuff, and it's going to make you better for this reason and this reason and this reason. And we're going to play at this pace for this reason. He explained everything that he was doing. So rather than just being a coach that says, you're going to do it because I told you to do it.
Which is the normal way
to go. Which
is the
way a lot of coaches do it. Kelly said, we're going to do this, and we're going to do it for this reason, and this is why we're going to be better. The player said, oh, I get it. And so initially, they immediately embraced all of this stuff. It's one of the reasons why he was successful in year one.
Treating them like grown-ups, Mike?
Yeah, how about that?
Really?
You know, it's really an interesting way of – it's a new look, I think, at the way basically you accomplish leadership. In a way, you know, there is that stereotype of a football coach at any level, high school, college, the NFL, that, you know, this is how I want it done because this is how I want it done, and I'm the coach and you're the player and you work for me, so you'll do it. Well, Chip doesn't work that way. Ask anybody in that locker room, you know, and it's rare that they say, well, Chip just told me to do it, so I did it. there is that give and take. You want that kind of, I mean, it gets to topics far beyond the NFL. It gets to how a CEO, you know, runs his company, or how an editor manages his newsroom or something like that. So, it's
fascinating.
It really is.
And that's Mike Sielski. He's a sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Also with us is Ray Didinger. He's a football analyst for Comcast Sportsnet here in Philadelphia. And we are talking about the Philadelphia Eagles, talking about this new coach, but coach that came in here last year, Chip Kelly, and kind of turned things around and changed the way the game is played, and also changed what appears to be the relationship between the coach and the players. And again, we want to hear from you, the sports fans, the Eagles fans in our audience. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. In fact, we have a tweet from Roberto. Is there danger that Chip becomes the flip side of Buddy Ryan and ignores defense, preventing SB, I guess that's Super Bowl win. I'm back to you, Mike.
I don't think he's ignoring it. I think there's a matter of, and I didn't cover Buddy Ryan. Ray did.
Yeah.
I'm only 20 years old. Ray's 100.
I knew there was a big difference. I wasn't sure how big it was.
But I don't think it's a matter of ignoring defense. I think Chip is somebody who, from his players to his coaches, tries to say, okay, what is somebody's strength, and how can I put them in a position to succeed, and if I trust somebody to do something, I will delegate him that responsibility. So he says to Bill Davis, you're my defensive coordinator, you run the defense, just keep me abreast of what you're doing and why you're doing it, and we'll go from there.
Yeah.
Buddy Ryan was defense, and you know, the offense, just go score me enough points and we'll be fine.
Go ahead, Ray.
No, I think that's true. Buddy was so dismissive of the other side of the ball that it ultimately brought his team down. I mean, he didn't care about drafting players for that side. He didn't care about developing parts of the offense. The offensive line was just kind of average when it needed to be better. They never really got running backs that could run the ball. He just depended on Randall Cunningham being a uniquely talented player.
Which he was.
Yeah, he was. And he just said, Randall, just go out there and run around and make a couple plays, and the defense will do the rest. Well, you can't win in the NFL like that. You know, and Chip understands that full well. Now, his main focus, obviously, is his offense. That's what he works with. But he's mindful of what the defense does. Now, he doesn't spend time in the defensive room. He leaves that to his defensive coordinator because he trusts him. But he also understands that I have to give him players, and I have to give him the time to do what he needs to do. He's not the way Buddy was, where he just didn't care about the other side of the ball. And that ultimately was part of the reason why that team never did win a Super Bowl. But I don't think Chip takes that same narrow-minded approach.
Is it too early to talk about SB Super Bowl, right?
Well, I think it's in play for this team. I mean, I certainly think that they're going to win this division because they're much the best team in this division. And that gets you to January. That gets you into the tournament. And then once you're there, you've got a chance.
I mean, Mike, we've all been this place before where you feel like, okay, this is the year. This is the year. And then something terrible happens.
Yeah, Ray and I were discussing that before the show. Our friend and colleague Rich Hoffman from the Daily News has this line that Philadelphia sports fans, Eagles fans in particular, spend most of their lives looking to the sky for the safe that's going to fall on their heads, like in a Bugs Bunny cartoon. And it is. It makes it challenging, I find, to evaluate teams accurately, because the Eagles are a team on the rise, and they are a team that can compete for a Super Bowl this season, who could theoretically and practically get there. But to say that in this town with this history, boy, you sound like a cockeyed optimist to do that, and you always have to be mindful that, well, you know, something usually happens, you know, that you don't expect to cause the Eagles either not to get the Super Bowl or not to win it once they get there, or whatever the case may be.
Let me get, looks like Ryan from Northern Liberties to join our conversation. Hi, Ryan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
Great. I just wanted to ask Ray if it were possible, which is more likely? He's won 6 Emmy Awards. Is it more likely the Eagles are going to win 6 games or 12 games this season?
Oh, dear. Are you putting it? Go ahead. Go ahead, Ray.
Well, if I have to choose between the two, they're more likely to win 12 than they are to win 6.
Nice.
Okay.
I mean, is that the choice? It's 6 or 12? I mean,
If I had to say which is more likely, I would say the 12.
Meaning
how many wins does it take to win the division?
To win the division.
Well, I'm already on record picking them to win the division at 10-6. Because I don't think there's another team in the division that's going to be better than 500. So I think they can win it with 10. 12 is a lot of wins. I think 10 is a more realistic figure.
What do you think, Mike?
I would say 11, not 10 or 11. They have a relatively tough schedule. They have a more challenging schedule this year than they did last year. They have to play the Seahawks late in the season in December, the defending Super Bowl champions. They have to go play the 49ers, who have been at least to the NFC Championship game, if not the Super Bowl, the last 3 years, and the Niners are beat up and have some issues, but they're still a formidable team. There tend to be games within that division. I agree with Ray that the NFC East is down. The Redskins, Cowboys, and Giants aren't as good as they've been in the past, but there's always a tough game or two that comes out of those games. But I think 10 to 11 wins is a realistic goal for this team.
And what do you think about Mark Sanchez as a quarterback?
This is really interesting to me because I worked at the Wall Street Journal before I came to the Inquirer and covered the Jets for 2 years. And at the time, Sanchez was kind of on the downside of his career with the Jets. The team had done well his first 2 years, and there were a lot of expectations for him, and he never met them again, and there was this kind of steep decline over his second 2 years there. So to see the way he's played in the preseason, he's been terrific. He seems healthier. He suffered an arm and shoulder injury last year that he's since recovered from. It's interesting because he was a page six guy with the New York Post. He was a New York Daily News back page cover boy. You know, the tabloids just were merciless to him while he was with the Jets. And now he can just kind of be in the shadows and put his career back together. And if he gets a chance to play this season because Nick Foles gets hurt or is ineffective, I think he'll do pretty well.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Ray?
No, I think he's reborn. And he's a player with talent. I mean, he was a high, high first-round draft choice. First 2 years in the league, he took the Jets to the conference championship game. Beat Peyton Manning and Tom Brady on the road. He got off his career off to a great start, and then things went spun terribly out of control. Not all his fault, mm-hmm. but it did. And it got to the point where, as Mike said, I mean, he was just getting pounded in the New York media to the point where I'm sure his confidence was shattered. So he needed to go somewhere else where he could get a fresh start. And he's gotten that in Philadelphia. But I've been covering this league a long time. I have seen a lot of quarterbacks that are resurrected with a second opportunity. I mean, you know, Rich Gannons, your Jim Plunkett's, your Kerry Collins's, Kurt Warner's. I mean, guys that played it out in one site, were written off, wound up going to another team as a backup, sort of regained their confidence, got another opportunity to play, and played very well. Now, I don't know if Sanchez is going to get to play here because Foles is clearly the guy. But the Eagles are in a good situation where if something happens to Foles and they need Sanchez for a game or two, I think he'll step in and play real well.
That's usually how it happens is an athlete comes to Philadelphia and has an easier time with it, with the media and the fans, right, Ray?
this is going to be, you're right, it generally goes the other way. This is going to be the reversal of that. I mean, you look at Sanchez now, I mean, he looks like a different guy, and you can't play any better than he played this preseason. I mean, he looked terrific.
And that's Ray Dinninger, football analyst for Comcast Sportsnet in Philadelphia here. His latest book, The New Eagles Encyclopedia, has been updated. In fact, he'll be speaking at the Free Library of Philadelphia on Saturday, September 20th at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, talking about the history of the Eagles. And we've been talking about the current team under its relatively new coach. Also with us is Mike Sielski. He's sports columnist with the Philadelphia Inquirer. And we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, and get back to our callers as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol use? The Family Training Program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them maintain control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the Family Training Program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2. Or online at iamconcerned.org.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember Joan Rivers, who has died at the age of 81. We'll listen back to excerpts of our three interviews with her from 1991, 2010, and 2012. Our tribute to Joan Rivers on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
30 years in the dark.
He was told, if you just admit to what you're doing, you'll get to go home. When Mr. McCullum signed the statement, he got up to walk out of the room. Law enforcement officer said, where are you going?
Two young brothers condemned for murder in 1983 and then set free this week. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Mike Sielski and Ray Dinger about the Philadelphia Eagles. They have a game on Sunday against Jacksonville, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Bill to join us. Bill from Paoli. Hi, Bill. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Marty. Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
Ray, as an historian, I've been wanting to answer this question for years, and going back to with Randall and Buddy, if Gary Anderson doesn't miss that field goal and the Vikings win the Super Bowl, is Randall a sure shot Hall of Fame candidate?
Candidate, yes. If he had won a Super Bowl, if they had finished off that year, and just for the listeners that aren't really hip to the story, Randall Cunningham finished his career in Philadelphia, and then the Eagles released him. He was actually out of football for an entire season. Then got picked up by the Minnesota Vikings and kind of did what we were talking about with Sanchez, kind of reinvented himself. Went to Minnesota as a backup, got an opportunity to play when the starter got hurt, and when he stepped in, played magnificently, played better there than he had ever played in Philadelphia. And actually, one year took the Vikings all the way to the championship game and set a league record for scoring points and was player of the year. They got to the championship game, and Gary Anderson, who was their kicker, who had not missed all year, missed a kick in the championship game that could have sent them to the Super Bowl. Now, if they had gone to the Super Bowl and won it, Randall Cunningham today would be a guy that people would be talking about as a Hall of Famer.
Wow.
As it's now turned out, he's never even made it to the final 15. But if that one thing, just winning a Super Bowl ring, can be the difference between getting to Canton or not.
To you, Mike, a question about the kicker Cody Parkey here in Philadelphia.
Yes.
Anything we should know about him?
He's 22. He looks 16. They brought him in within the last two or three weeks because they were unsatisfied with their kicker who had been here the previous 3 years, a guy named Alex Henry, who had been the most accurate kicker in the history of college football during his career at Nebraska, and then got here with the Eagles and just kind of gradually over his time here started missing kicks that he ought to make. And it was one of those things where his statistically speaking, you look at him and say, oh, he's pretty good. But if you had watched him kick and you watched, you noticed when he missed field goals, it was the sort of thing where you said, oh, I'm not sure we can trust this guy when push comes to shove. So, you know, a few days ago, the Eagles signed a trade for this kid, Cody Parkey from Indianapolis, and he ends up kicking very well during the preseason. He hits two long field goals. 53 yards against the Jets, and so he wins the job. The Eagles cut Alex Henry and are going with Cody Parkey, which is it's interesting and it's not. Kickers are kind of even more fungible as football players than just about any position out there. It's a lot easier to find a kicker than it is a starting quarterback.
Yeah.
I think he'll do pretty well. He seems like a confident young man.
Seems like, though, such a tough job. I mean, because you spend most of the time just on the sidelines waiting for your couple minutes on the field, and sometimes it's one of those make-or-break plays, Ray.
It's a very hard job. It's a very hard job because even though they say that you're part of the team and the guys try to accept you, you're not. You know,
you're not.
You're the lonesome kicker.
I mean,
and they love you or hate you.
They're always off by themselves. And you know, at the end of the game, if they get called upon to either, imagine their situation they're in. I mean, the guys on your team have fought their guts out for 3 hours, and they're all bloody and they're worn out and they're beat up, and then with 10 seconds to go, you in your clean uniform come on the field, and now it's up to you to either make the kick or not make the kick. And if you make it, you win. But if you miss it, you know what? You've let all those guys down. And
they're bigger than you.
And the thing is, the way of the NFL now is that kickers, there's like no margin for error anymore. I mean, if you don't make 90% of your field goal attempts from almost any distance, you're just not good enough, and they're going to be looking for the next guy. And 40 yards, 50 yards, it doesn't matter. If you have a kick, you got to make it.
Let me get Robert from, it looks like Chestnut Hill, to join our conversation. And Robert, go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
Question for Ray or Mike. As far as adaptability and ego with Chip Kelly, last year you said well, you said earlier in the show that he was able to make changes on the fly and adapt to different offenses or defenses. And last year when he should probably have run the clock out and to eat up time because his system requires, a very quick-paced offense, he didn't slow it down. It was like, did his, ego get involved with he could just run more plays and outscore someone when logically he really should have slowed the game down, and will he learn from that? Is that a rookie mistake, or what do you think?
That's an interesting question. Mike, let me toss that first to you.
I think part of it was that was the way he had always done things at Oregon. There was never really, first of all, there was never much of a need for him to slow things down.
He never had a close game.
Yeah, I mean, they're winning games by 30, 40 points. So you can just go, and you're ahead 45-3, and okay, well, we'll just keep running what we're running because the other team isn't going to come back. And there were a handful of situations last year where the Eagles got out to big leads, including in his very first game as head coach, and kind of had to scramble at the end to hold off another team. I think I'd like to think he's learned from that. It seemed like they got a little bit better with that towards the end of the year. So, we'll see.
He seems like a learner.
Oh, yeah.
Chip Kelly.
Yeah, I think early on he had to learn how to coach in close games. Yeah. I mean, in college, they not only won every game, they won games by ridiculous margins. So in the fourth quarter, there really wasn't much to coach. When you come up the NFL, you're not going to win every week like that. Even if you win, you're generally winning close. So you have to learn how to coach that strategy. And I thought that he got better at it as the year went along. I mean, there was a game, particularly there was a game in Green Bay late in the season, where they had a lead in the fourth quarter. And they actually ran out the last, I think, almost 7 minutes of the fourth quarter, where they didn't huddle, but they moved more slowly, and they worked more of the clock, they bled more of the clock, they ran the ball, they kept the clock going, and they took it all the way down that the Green Bay never got the ball back. That's the kind of stuff that he's going to have to learn how to do.
What's interesting about that, the example that Ray used there, the Green Bay game, getting back to what we discussed earlier in the show about Chip being unorthodox, is one of the reasons they were able to run the clock down in that game, Bill Davis, the defensive coordinator, told me just a couple weeks ago, was that they used Nick Foles as a runner as often as they did over the last 7 minutes. When Nick would come to the line of scrimmage, he'd look around and Chip would look around and they'd say, well, the one thing the Packers defense isn't accounting for is the quarterback running with the football. So they just kept running Nick and running Nick, and he would only get 4 yards or he might only get 3 yards, but the Eagles kept moving the ball. They held on to the ball. The Packers couldn't get it back, couldn't mount a comeback, and the Eagles win the game.
And he's not much of a runner, as both of you have intimated.
It's like trying to pour cold molasses, I think.
He's that slow?
Yeah, well, the year he came out in college, all the players go to what they call the combine, where they work them all out and they time them, and Nick was the slowest quarterback out of the bunch, and by a lot. I mean, he was running a time that was more like a lineman. I mean, he's a good athlete, but he's not a fast runner, and you can be both, and he's an example of that.
Let's get back to let me just quickly reintroduce everybody. I got confused there. Ray Dittinger, Mike Sielski, our guests in this hour of Radio Times, getting a preview of the Eagles season, which starts on Sunday. And again, any questions or comments, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. I do want to talk to you about concussion and the problem of concussion and football. We've done shows about how the NFL has either handled or mishandled the whole situation, but clearly it's a very disturbing development when it comes to this game, and both of you clearly know the game, are fans of the game as well. Do you, Mike, struggle with concussion? I think for some more casual viewers or observers, they're just done with it. They just don't want to see these hits on the field. They don't want to see players getting injured.
I do struggle with it. I have two young sons, a three-year-old and a month-and-a-half-old. And I wonder if they want to play, if they tell me, Daddy, I want to play football, what would I say to them? Not because I would say, oh, it's so violent that, I'm not going to let you play. I mean, that's a component of it. Part of it is that we're still learning to a great extent the after effects of what concussions are. I mean, you don't know. There's no way to tell how damaging one could be or how you could sustain one or how long it would take you to recover from one. But by the same token, I also see the benefits that competitive sports and football in particular can provide to a young person or to somebody in the NFL or college, whatever level you're talking about. So it is something that, as a father,
sure,
I struggle with. As a sports writer, you struggle with it too, because you're trying to figure out exactly, okay, well, what do people – want to hear about? What do they need to hear about? Is this a topic that football fans, you know, want to know more about, or they just want to know who won the game and how did they win the game and the X's and O's and all those sorts of things? It's really a complex topic.
Do you think football fans, though, want to know? I mean, this casts a bit of a shadow, I think, over this
I think to
game.
A certain extent, a lot of them don't want to know. A lot of them would prefer not to think about it and just say, let me sit there on the Sunday afternoon and enjoy my game and, you know, drink my beer and eat my food and maybe talk to my bookie every now and again, and that'll be that. And there's nothing wrong with that, but that doesn't mean that you should completely ignore, you know, what else is going on.
What do you think, Ray?
Well, I'm all in favor of making the game as safe as it can be, and whatever you need to do in testing equipment, testing headgear, stuff that you can make it safer, absolutely. Modifying the rules to limit headshots, guys leading with their helmet, those kinds of hits, trying to get those out of the game, absolutely appropriate. I've often thought, and I advocated a couple years ago, people looked at me like I was crazy, but I advocated make the field bigger, widen the field. Expand the field, because you know you got everybody assumes it's a given that the players are, you know, they're bigger, faster than they've ever been. It's absolutely true. They're bigger and faster than they've ever been, but they're playing on the same box that Red Grange played on 70 years ago. So I think the players may have outgrown the playing field, and I would be in favor of expanding the field, widening the field a little bit, giving these guys a little more room, taking away. You're not going to take away the collisions because the sport is built on collisions. But I think if you gave these guys a little more room to operate, I'm not saying
fewer injuries. Do you think
it's not going to take all of it away? But I kind of think when I look at the players and the way the game is played today, the speed at which it's played and the size at which the players are, and they're playing on the same field that they played 100 years ago, I think maybe it might be worth revisiting it and maybe expanding the field and opening it up a little bit. And I think it might make it not a totally – you're not ever going to take the contact out, but I think you could make it a safer game.
What do you think about that, Mike?
That's an interesting idea. I don't – in theory it would, you know, that players would, you know, be – when they make their contact, there would be less – likely to be collisions as opposed to grabbing somebody by the ankle and having to drag them down because they have more room to maneuver and those sorts of things. But Ray hit on the point, though, which is that these players are bigger and faster and stronger than they've ever been before, and they're basically armored in a way that enables them to turn themselves into human missiles in a way. You know, a guy, you put on those pads, you feel indestructible. Never mind what some of them might be putting in their bodies to feel that way. So, you know, I don't know. I think it's an issue that's just endemic to a contact sport like football, and it's something that we're going to be grappling with for a long, long time, no matter what changes we make.
And here's a related email from Paul. Will the projected tougher enforcement of the rules for defensive holding benefit a team like the Eagles, where offense is their strength?
It may or may not. I think that what they're trying to do is they're trying to minimize more defensive contact to open things up for the offense, to allow teams to throw the ball more freely, make more big plays, and score more points. Every time the league puts through a new set of rules, it's always geared towards favoring the offense because they know that people like big plays and they like touchdowns. There's also fantasy football players out there that want their yards and they want their points. A lot of this is catering to that. Does it help an offensive team like the Eagles? Yeah, maybe somewhat. But the part I would take away from that a little bit is if there are more penalties, it slows the game. And if it slows the game and it takes the pace of the game away, that works against the Eagles because the Eagles want to run plays one after another. And they don't want to stand around and wait for the officials to decide what they want to do. They want to keep moving the ball, pressing the issue. And so while on the one hand you say, yeah, an offense like the Eagles would benefit by that, yes, maybe, but I think what it would take away in terms of the speed at which they want to play would be a problem.
Mike?
Interesting. I'm not sure how this is going to play out. I want to see the officials in the heat of a regular season game, particularly a late season game or a playoff game, call these penalties with the same frequency that they did during the preseason. The Seahawks won the Super Bowl last year. They led the league in defensive holding and pass interference penalties last year, and that's not by accident. It was actually part of their strategy because they basically said, we're going to grab you and hold you as an opposing receiver as often as we can, and we're going to dare the officials to call a penalty on every play, and we bet that they won't. And even though they got flagged more than anybody else, they were willing to take the trade-off of, if we do it on every play, there's going to be enough plays where the other team doesn't catch the
ball.
And
that was their strategy?
And that was their strategy. It was part of what they did defensively.
No, they won the championship.
They won the Super Bowl. So let me see the referees and the back judges and everybody else call these penalties as often as they've been called in the preseason, and then I'll decide whether it's going to help or hurt the Eagles.
Yeah, I don't think they will. I mean, we saw it all through the preseason that they're penalty after penalty after penalty, and the games became unwatchable. They were just terrible. So I don't think, and everybody said, oh, God, is this going to carry over into the regular season? No. I think the officials were trying to send a message in the preseason that this is the way we want the game officiated. This is the way we want the game played. Okay, these are the rules as we are going to interpret them and going to call them. But they're not going to do it in the regular season, because if they do it in the regular season, and you're going to wind up with three and a half hour games, 3 hour and 45 minute games, and the TV networks aren't going to allow it, because the TV networks want the 1 o'clock games over by 4, and they want the 4 o'clock games over by 7, and so they don't want games that are going to be running 4 hours. And TV money is what operates that. That's the fuel in the engine of the NFL. And if the TV networks aren't happy, then the NFL can't do that.
We're almost out of time here, Mike. I heard a story on NPR yesterday that perhaps, I'm not sure, all teams, but some of these players are going to be wearing sensors so that perhaps viewers can be sort of watching their, I don't know, their heart rate. I'm not sure what they'll be watching. But the idea of putting sensors on players and allowing us to...
Well, this is something that the NFL's been working on for a while. We see cameras in the locker room before a game now. You know, there's smartphone technology. The Link has just, Lincoln Financial Field has just kind of updated its technology so that you can, pay attention to your smartphone and get Wi-Fi while you're at the game. You know, one of the concerns that the league had over the last several years was that attendance was not rising commensurate with the money that they were making. And they kind of felt like, well, people are staying home to watch, NFL red zone coverage on cable TV, and that things were just better. It was better to watch a game at home. So they're trying to kind of enhance the experience as much as they can.
Well, Mike Sielski, as always, thanks for joining us today on Radio Time, sports columnist with the Philadelphia Inquirer. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. And Ray Dinger, thank you for joining us as well.
My pleasure.
And he said, just took a big glass of water there, football analyst for Comcast Sportsnet here in Philadelphia. And his latest book, The New Eagles Encyclopedia, has been updated. And again, he's speaking at the Free Library of Philadelphia Saturday, September 20th at 3 in the afternoon. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Two thumbs up for you, Kevin. Thanks, as always, for helping me talk about sports on Radio Times. Emily Hawes helping us out today. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.